We've been doing this series, Life Hacks, for the last few weeks, only this last month. And I've really enjoyed it. It's been a fantastic opportunity to really look at things that make a difference in life. Now, if you know Life Hacks on the internet, you get Life Hacks, and they're all about little things that you can do to make things a little bit easier, a little bit more cute. And for the most part, they're useless. They're absolutely trivial. They've got no real bearing on anything that really affects us as people. But we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could do a series of life hacks that were small practices that made a big difference in your actual life? If you could do something small, if you could actually get your head around these small things, then it could make a big difference in how you do life and how you experience life. And so you can catch up, if you've not seen all of them, with the website. It's woodlandschurch.net, woodlandsmetro.church, either will work, / life hacks. But we went through a few of them. So this week, we're going to look at life hack number 5. It's our final one. And the life hack is this: how to exceed expectations. How do you exceed expectations? You know, how do you go for life? Because most of us, we start off with great desire, great ambition, great plans, great hope. But somehow, when we get older, by the time you've reached your age, you've dialed things back a little bit. You've reduced your expectations. Wouldn't it be amazing? Wouldn't it be great if you could have a life which actually goes further than you were expecting? If you could be involved in a community that actually delivered more than you were anticipating? If you could be involved in a job where your impact in that job, that career, that work far exceeded anything that you had anticipated before? Wouldn't it be amazing if you could have relationships and friendships and impact that exceeds your dreams? So just a quick recap on the hacks that we've had so far. The first one, life hack number 1, was focus on who, not just what. It's important to think about the kind of person that you want to be. The second one was actually about finding a mentor, because for most of us, we're going to need someone that's going to come alongside us, get behind us, and pray over us. That will actually unlock something in our lives. For the third one, we actually talked about finding a small group who will help you make good decisions, and the need to have people who will tell you things as they really are, not just go around with a peer group. And then last week, we had this thing: when you make a mistake, when you make a mess, make it right. But this week, the life hack number 4, is quite simply this. It is: make a commitment to something bigger than yourself. Everyone say that with me. Make a commitment to something bigger than yourself. We all need something bigger than ourselves in our lives. And if you're not a Christian, if you're not sure that you're a church person, actually, this is so, so true, that all of us, we need to have something bigger in our lives than just the everyday stuff that we somehow often settle on. And what we want to do is the thing that we've been doing all this last few weeks with the series, is to focus on an individual from history, from scripture, from the Bible, and take a look at their lives and see the example that they give and see what we can learn from them. So this time we're going back into the Old Testament, where we go all the way back from Jesus, 1100 years. There it comes again. You enjoyed it last week, you enjoy it this week. All the way to Ruth. Now, that was, in the space of just a couple seconds, 1,100 years. 1,100 years. So whenever we talk about the Old Testament and the New Testament, basically the New Testament is all the stuff that happens after Jesus. The Old Testament is all the stuff that happens before Jesus. And so these characters we've been looking at, they're in the Old Testament. So literally 1,100 years before Jesus. Ruth was actually the great-grandmother of David that we looked at last week. And so if we think about where Ruth is located, Ruth is part of the Old Testament. You see the map there. You've got the Mediterranean, the Middle East. And if you zoom into the nation of Israel, then you'll see that Israel is here. And the place where the story starts is actually in a town called Bethlehem, a little town called Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is there. A woman called Naomi, she has her husband there. His name is Elimelech. And what happens is they have this incredible famine that goes through the whole country. And so what they decide to do is they decide that they're going to move into Moab, which is a neighboring nation. It's just there to the east. So Moab is there to the east of the Dead Sea. In fact, if you're interested in knowing a little bit about Jesus, he was actually born in Bethlehem, the little town, but he lived up in Nazareth, which is right at the top of the map by the Sea of Galilee. You see it following up the Jordan. So they go into Moab, which is just a foreign country. They've got their foreign gods, they've got their foreign ways. And Naomi, her name means pleasant. Her husband Elimelech and her two sons, she had two sons. Now their names were Mahlon and Chilion. Funny story. Mahlon and Chilion in the Bible, if you look at the meaning of their names, and you can actually look it up and you can get Bible dictionaries and all kinds of clever stuff, or you can just Google it. But Mahlon and Chilion have these very, it's weird because they have these funny names. And I think that there's something about their names that comes about because they were born in a time of famine. So there's no bread. It's funny because the name Bethlehem actually means house of bread. And yet the irony is these people who live in a town called Bethlehem, the house of bread, they find themselves without food, and so they find their children malnourished. And so Mahlon literally means sickly. And Chilion literally means pining. You know, I've got no food, Mom, I'm pining. Yeah, well, I'm sick. Listen to your brother. And they had these kind of sick, pining children. What happens to sick and pining is that they marry two girls in Moab, which you're not really supposed to do. You're not supposed to marry someone from a different religion in the Old Testament. You're not supposed to marry someone from a different nation. And they were traditionally kind of at loggerheads. They were enemies. But these guys, they kind of went over and they said, look, I might have a faith, but I've got to live. I might believe that God is real, but I'm not sure I trust him with my life. And so Naomi and Elimelech, they go into this foreign country and they think, we'll make a life here. And they get women for their sons. Two wives for Mahlon and Chilion, one each. One wife is called Orpah, and one wife is called Ruth. Now, a sad story. Elimelech, he dies. So Naomi is now a widow. Secondly, Mahlon, he dies. Thirdly, don't laugh, Chilion, he dies. So there's Orpah and Ruth, and they have this kind of conversation with one another. And they said, you married a man called sickly. I married a man called pining. They both died. How did we not see this one coming? And so you've now got these three widows. And they decide that what they're going to do is they're going to move from Moab to Bethlehem. They're going to cross over back into their home nation. And it's a sad, sad story. So the book of Ruth, and you really should read this. I can't really go into all of it. It's only four chapters. It won't take you very long to read. But it's really, really worth reading. And it's a story of people who lose their faith in God. In fact, Naomi, she says, my name is supposed to be pleasant. My life is not pleasant. It's a joke. It's a sick, twisted, ironic joke. When you call me my name, every time you speak to me, you're saying, hey, pleasant one. Hey, one that has a pleasant life. My life is not pleasant. Where is God? Where's God when my husband died? Where's God when my firstborn died? Where's God when my only remaining living relative died? She says, don't call me Naomi anymore. Call me Mara. Mara means bitter. She says, my life's not pleasant. My life is bitter. And so what they do is they move from Moab up to the border with Israel. And then she speaks to her daughters-in-law who've been accompanying her on this trip. And this is where we pick it up in chapter 1. It says this. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness. Everyone say kindness. That word's really, really important. In fact, it's kind of the key of this book, Ruth. Whatever you get from it, Mahlon, Chilion, sickly, pining, bitter, the whole thing is about the kindness of God. Wouldn't you like God's kindness in your life? Maybe you've had an experience. Maybe you feel a little bit like Naomi who becomes Mara. Maybe you felt like, well, I prayed to God and he didn't stop my loved one from dying. Or I prayed to God and I still lost my job. Or I prayed to God and here I am in this dead-end marriage. Or I prayed to God, but here I still am struggling with depression. And you may feel like your life hasn't exceeded expectations. You may feel like your life hasn't even met expectations. But here, Ruth is a story about God showing kindness. The Hebrew word kindness, it's hesed. It means, well, I tell you what it means. It's kind of the closest word in the Old Testament that relates to grace. The kindness of God, the favor of God, the grace of God. I want you to have the grace of God. I want you to have the kindness of God. And she prays for these two girls. And here's the question, are they going to get it? Are they going to experience the kindness of God? What about you? Are you going to experience God's kindness in your life? Are you going to experience God's grace? Is there anything at all that you can do in order to put yourself in a place where you can receive God's grace? She says, may the Lord show you kindness, grace, favor, as you've shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. She goes on, then she kissed them goodbye and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband, even if I thought there was still hope for me. Even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me. At this, they wept aloud again. Now listen to this. Then Orpah kissed. Everyone say, kissed. Yes. Nice. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Everyone say, clung. Okay, and then the next bit is the famous bit from Ruth. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates us. This is the question you have to ask yourself. And this is the difference between these two women. Do you kiss or do you cling? Orpah, she goes to her mother-in-law and she loves her. There's no doubt that she loves her. They're weeping, they're heartbroken. They become close. They rely on one another. They've been through difficult times, through thick and thin. And Orpah, she loves her mother-in-law, but at the end of the day, she kisses her and then moves away. But Ruth is the one that clings onto her. Ruth clings and won't let go. When I was a kid, I was brought up with, I had just the one brother. And my dad is like a Nigerian. My dad's Nigerian. My mom's English. My dad, he's like, he had the body of a demigod. He was huge, muscles everywhere, muscles in places where most men don't even have places. And my dad was big and my dad was strong and my dad was cool. And we used to, every Saturday morning, we used to do wrestling with my dad. My brother was 4 years old, younger than me. And so he was just little. But I'd be there and I'd be 12 years old. My brother, he'd be 8 years old. And my dad, he had this obsession with wrestling. Now, I don't mean worldwide wrestling, WWF or whatever, WWE or, you know, Hulk Hogan and all those kind of The Rock. Not that stuff. I mean, good old-fashioned, back-to-basics English wrestling from Yorkshire when men were real men and they used to break other men all over their knee. People, you won't know about these, but people like Big Daddy, Giant Haystacks, and it used to be on ITV on Saturday mornings. My dad would watch this stuff. My dad would say, hey, let me try some of these things out on you boys. And so he'd come and he'd ka-ka-ka and piled up. And my brother and me, we loved it. And then we do this kind of concerted effort. Right, let's get him. Let's bring him down. Come on, charge. Ah! And I would grab a hold of one leg and I would cling. And then my brother would grab a hold of the other leg and he would cling. cling. And then we would try and get our arms around each other so that we had his legs bound tight. We're clinging on, clinging on, clinging on, clinging on, clinging on. And then my dad would go like a felled tree. Down onto the sofa. We'd all jump on his head and yell and cheer. We brought Dad down. Thinking about it now, I guess we just held his legs. So actually reviewing it, probably he let us win. If he'd done what he wanted to do, he could have just bashed our heads in with his fists. But no, he would just go over like a felled oak. And it was the most delightful thing ever. But we would cling on and he would sort of be shuffling around. Oh, you kids, I'll get you off. And try and just shake us off. We're clinging on, going round like a bucking bronco. And then clinging, clinging, clinging. I will not let you go. I will not let you go. No matter what you do to me, no matter what happens, no matter the outcome, I will not let you go. That is what Ruth does for Naomi. She says, listen, I don't care what you go through. I don't care what you face. I don't care what the outcome is. I will go with you. I will cling on to you. I will not let you go. There's something very, very powerful about this. In fact, very often, this passage where you go, I will go. Where did it go? There it is. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. They use this at weddings. Do you know why? Because the word cling, where it says that that Ruth clings to Naomi. That word cling is the same word that is used right in the very beginning of the Bible in Genesis, where it says, for this reason, a man will leave his family and cling or cleave, cling to his wife. In the New Testament, they translate this word cling as the Greek word. It's a translation of a Greek word kalao, which is where we get the English word collagen. It actually literally means glue. Collagen is kind of the glue that binds your body together. And so the idea that a husband and wife can be glued to one another, it's talking about the most intense commitment that two people can make to each other. And this is what Ruth exhibits, kiss or cling. Now, I want to just talk to you a little bit. This is a little bit of a detour, but it's an interesting one. It's all about commitment theory. See, people, and this is just, it's kind of new, it's just from the 90s, but people are figuring out what makes commitment, what makes couples stay together. And there's two things. One is called dedication, and the other is called constraints. Dedication and constraints. Dedication and constraints. Now, constraints, if we get that up, constraints is all about these things. It's about your family and your friends. It's about your living arrangements. It's about the kind of the faff that would be involved in you not being together. So couples stay together because of external forces. An external force like, well, we live together, we have a mortgage together, we share our bills together. It would be such a hassle if we weren't together. If we broke up, it's just too much hassle. It's too much to think about. We've got our family, we've got our friends, we've got people that rely on us, people that are looking to us, people that treat us. You know, I don't want to break up with you because I'm really friendly with, you know, my brother-in-law, or family as in the children that we've produced. You know, these are external things that bind you together. Those the external things that make it difficult for people to not be together. Secondly, you've got dedication. Now, dedication is the internal things. It's things like a focus on the future. It is about someone that counts the cost, and it's when people define themselves by something greater. In other words, I don't just define myself by me, I define myself by us. Now, here's the thing. You have this dedication where you say, I will go with you, I will trust in you, I will believe in you, and I will follow you. You've got the willingness to go through difficult times, to go through hardship, to count the cost. And then you say, I'm not just me, I'm part of something bigger. Dedication. So if we put dedication and constraints together, here's what can happen. You can have a relationship that has low dedication but high constraints. And what that means is the people that are in a relationship, a couple that are in a relationship, there are a lot of external forces on them, but their internal drivers for making the relationship work and for sticking at it, these are low. And so, this is going to be a little bit personal. I'm just debating whether I should tell this or not. Kate, who started our evening off, that's my wife. And, do you know what? In for a penny, in for a pound. When we were young and we were married, we found ourselves in a situation where the marriage wasn't always easy. Things weren't always plain sailing. And I can remember the most difficult time, and, you know, I'm not going to name any names, but we had a little baby. And this little baby came into our lives and our little idyllic relationship with one another suddenly changed. And I can remember feeling constraints. Because I remember having this one really blazing route with Kate, and the little baby was on the floor and just whining away. Little baby. And Kate was just, you know, none of us had slept. We just didn't know which end was up and which end was down. And I can remember we had this right. I can't remember what started it. I think I'd been a bad person. That's usually the brunt of most of our rounds. And I remember I had this glass. I remember this kind of cut crystal glass. It wasn't crystal, it was just normal glass. But I had this glass, and I was sitting at the table, and I had this glass, and I don't think I've told anyone this before. I just wanted to throw it at her. I wanted to throw it at her face, and just, I couldn't do it because I'm a man of God. This bar is being set really low. And so what I did was I just took the glass and I threw it down on the floor. It smashed in lots of tiny shards of glass all over the little baby. And Kate's like, great, are you happy now? Look at what you've done. You're a horrible person. And I'm like, I don't need this. I'm not taking this. And I stormed out and she had the house and I went to the church office. And I remember sleeping on a sofa in the church office conference room. And it was not very good. And so I sort of went back at 3 a.m. and I said, okay, should we talk? No, I don't want to talk. Well, let's talk anyway. And we somehow managed to get through it. But when you are having difficulty, when you feel like your dedication is low, the constraints that you've got, the fact that we have a baby together, the fact that we live together, the fact that we're in a house together, the fact that we sleep on the same bed. And if I don't sleep in the same bed with you, I've got to sleep on a blooming sofa somewhere. Those constraints make you feel what? Trapped. And actually, when people have in their relationships, when they have a low dedication, so a lack of desire to really count the cost through the difficult times, when they have a lack of vision for the future that it's going to go anywhere, and when they see themselves as individuals rather than as a we, as a couple, as a together entity, and you've got these big constraints, the constraints actually work against you. This is what happens. You have a bad relationship. You have low satisfaction ratings in your relationship, and your relationship is much more likely to fail. And that's why, and I say this, you know, just humbly, but this is what the research shows. The research shows again, 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 couples who cohabit before engagement are much more likely to divorce once married than couples who cohabit after they've been engaged or when they get married. Living together, this thing with cohabitation. He's from Mexico, give him a round of applause. It's actually my fault. I blame Steve Jobs. When you have constraints that hold you together, it actually leads to unstable relationships. And that's why couples that live together are far more likely to break up than couples that actually marry. And couples who live together before they get married, weirdly enough, are more likely to divorce than couples who don't live together. Because what you want is you want high dedication as well as high constraints. And when that high dedication is up, when I'm really focusing on the future, when I'm really counting the cost, when I'm seeing myself as part of something greater, it changes everything. It makes the relationship good, even when you're going through hard times.
And I can remember those early days with the baby, when we would be walking down the high street of Cobham, where we lived in Surrey. And I can remember seeing families walking on the other side of the road. I have a distinct memory of seeing this old couple, and they had teenage children, and I checked them out. I was looking for signs of familial resemblance. Yes, the children, all of them, looked like both of the parents. Clearly, these people had sired these children, and yet still they were together. In fact, they were walking together, and they were arm in arm, and they were laughing, and they looked okay. And I felt like running up to them and saying, how do you do it? How is it possible to stay together through these difficult times? But having a focus on the future, I thought, it's got to be possible. Maybe one day, we will be those people that can walk down the high street happy and smiling and holding hands. Maybe we can get through our difficulties. When you have a focus on the future, and you bring that sort of sense of internal dedication back, it really changes things. The weird thing is that even if you have high dedication and low constraints, you still get a good relationship. We could be living in separate places for a time. You might not have a house together. You might be independently wealthy, so I don't need the other person just to survive. I don't need, you know, some people, my father, well, he has a separate house from his wife. Figure that one out. But it can work. It can work if you've got the high dedication. So this is what Ruth does. Ruth says, I will go where you go. Where you stay, I will stay. In other words, she has a strong focus on the future. This is where I'm going. This is what I will, I will, I will, I will, I will. She's not saying, well, I'm staying here while the going is good. She's saying, no, no matter what, right off into the future, even till I die, then I'm going to be with you. She counts the cost. So she says, look, my own people, I'll let that go. I'll sacrifice my own family, my own people, my own culture, everything I know. I'm going to count the cost and I'm going to be with you. And when she says, if I die, where you die, I will die. Literally going as a widow. I mean, she's a refugee, right? You get the whole refugee crisis. It's not a bundle of laughs. She's a refugee going back into Israel, and she is looking at absolute economic destitution. You are the lowest of the low when you're a single woman who has no one to care for in that society. But she's willing to count the cost. And then she says, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely. She makes a vow. If even death separates us. I'm not just me. I'm part of us. I see something bigger than just my own self. And so what happens is that she goes into Israel. They finally find their way back into Bethlehem. And she goes into this situation where she's just trying to get some food. And she finds that they've actually gone back into their sort of family territory where they've got distant relatives and closer relatives. And what they do is the only way that they can survive is to go and get, when they're doing the barley harvest, and when the men are carrying in the hops, any little bits of strays that they drop, you can just pick up a stray ear of corn here and there. They call it gleaning. And so the men would do the kind of the combine harvester thing. And then the poor and the widows would come in behind and they just pick up stuff. And what happens is that news of her commitment, her amazing commitment to Naomi gets out. And there's this guy, he's called Boaz. He is a wealthy landowner, and he is someone who is seen as a great guy, a hero. His name means strong, and he's counted in the Bible as being this great, amazing guy. Single, by the way. And he has this farm, and he has these guys, and he hears about Ruth, and so he says to his men, two things. One, okay, definitely no raping. Two, leave some extras for her. And so Ruth is going along, and she's not getting hassled or molested by the guys. And she's finding all these sort of huge hunks of barley left. And she's thinking, man, these workers are sloppy. I mean, they're just leaving stuff. Everyone, she comes back laden. And then her mother-in-law, Naomi, says, look, I think something's going on here. I think you found something. I think you found an ally. Go and speak to Boaz. And she says this. Boaz basically says, well, I've told my men not to attack you, and you can take water from where we take water at any time. And at this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. Why have I found such favor in your eyes? And there's that word again. It's favor, it's grace, it's kindness. Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? Boaz replied, I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with the people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord. That phrase, richly rewarded, it literally, the Hebrew word, you will have heard of it, it is shalom. It means the goodness, the kindness, the wholeness, the blessing, the harmony of God. May you have the rich shalom of the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. And so that idea of kindness, the kindness of God, there's something about what Ruth did that brings her into a place where she can receive kindness, where she can receive grace, where she can receive shalom from God. And actually all the guys that we've been looking at, with the exception of Rehoboam, who's a negative object lesson because he got it all wrong. When we look at Rehoboam, we're saying, don't do that. Listen to Alex's preach. Make sure you don't do that stuff. Okay, so Rehoboam's a bad example, but everyone else. Daniel, he experiences favor, compassion, kindness. It says this for Daniel. Daniel resolved not to defile himself. Now, God calls the official to show favor and kindness to Daniel. With Esther, when she commits herself, she says, by thy Allah, she pleased him, the people in charge of her, and won his kindness. And Esther won the favor of everyone. She got grace. And David is the one who cries out that first verse of Psalm 51. It says, have mercy on me, O God, according to your loving kindness, Hesed. And so this is the big idea that we've got today. And it's this. When you put yourself in a place of commitment, you put yourself in a place of grace. If you want to exceed your expectations, you can't do this on your own. You need God to get involved. If you want to have your life mean something, make an impact, have the kind of results that you dream of, you can't do it on your own. You can't achieve this on your own. You need God's grace. And if you're here and you're not a church person, you haven't ever committed your life to Jesus, I just want to say to you this. This is how it works. You get a good relationship when you make a commitment. That's what all the research shows. That's what all the studies show. And that's what we know. When you stick with someone, when you make a commitment, when you go through the cost, you see the couple as bigger than just my, you know, I'm willing to sacrifice for this. You get a great relationship at the end of it. It doesn't come for free. Nothing of value comes without cost. But even more so, in your relationship with God, if you're willing to make a commitment, then you put yourself in a place where God says, I can work with that. I can bless you. I can give you grace. I can show kindness to you. Not just you, but I can allow other people to give you favor and give you grace. There's something about people that will make a commitment that puts them in a place where God can really do something significant and special in their lives. For Ruth, actually, she ends up, there's this kind of little courtship that happens between Boaz and Ruth. He's kind of like the older gentleman, silver fox, very wealthy, so kind of, you know. And she's the beautiful, young, foreign woman with a funny accent and a kind of a cute way of looking at things. And they basically, he says, look, I'm interested in you, you're interested in me. But there's one thing in our culture, someone else has they have this thing where they call it a guardian redeemer. Someone who has a better claim on the kind of the family connection can actually buy your land, buy Naomi's land because her husband's died. Someone needs to buy that land from her, and when they buy that land, they have to sort of marry. It's just what we do, you know, buy a farm, marry the woman. That's how it works. And someone else has got prior claim. But I'm going to go and I am going to do everything I can to pay a cost, to pay a price for you. Because I see you as special and I see you as valuable and I want to be with you. And this is what's happened. So Boaz took Ruth, the other guy bailed, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive. She gave birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer." Now he became famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The woman living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. That's how the book ends. The book ends with her actually becoming, from this foreign, destitute woman, she becomes one of the ancestors of Jesus Christ himself. What I want to do as we finish is I want to pray a prayer. And I want to invite you to pray a prayer. It may be that there are some of you and you've never committed yourself fully to Jesus. You've never really given your all. What you do is you kind of kiss. In fact, you come to church on a Sunday, you get close to Jesus, and you have a kind of little, like, peck-on-the-cheek kind of relationship with God, and then you move away, and you do your own thing, and you live your own life, and you make your own decisions, and you don't count the cost, and you don't look to the future. And sometimes, when you find life difficult, and when you find like God hasn't answered your prayers, or when you go through a difficult time, that's it. Your faith is rocky, you find it difficult, you walk away. But God is saying, look, I'm looking for people who will commit to me. I'm looking for people, and there's something about commitment that puts you in a place of grace. It's only when you say, God, I'm willing to give everything I have to you. God, I'm willing to see myself in terms of your purposes for the world, part of your church. In fact, I want to invite you not just to make a commitment to God, but to make a commitment to his purposes, to his people. For our own part in Metro, you know, we've talked about this before. We talk about find, follow, love, and serve. That we want to be a church that helps people find Jesus. We want to be a church that helps people follow Jesus. We want to be a church that helps people love one another and then serve our city. That's, quite frankly, why we do Give It Up. Not because we think, hey, it'd be nice to do some sponsored stuff for charity. No, we do it because we want to serve the city. We want to make an impact on those that need it the most. We see that as part of our commitment to God. But I'd like to invite you to pray with me. And basically to pray a prayer of commitment. And what will happen is, I'm going to pray, I'm going to lead you, and you can pray my prayer and make it your own. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave a little pause. I'm going to leave you a chance just to say your own stuff to God. The things that you want him to do for you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lead, I will lead. I may feel like my life has got bitter. I may feel like things haven't worked out. It may take huge faith for me to believe in you. But I'm signing up. So let's pray right now. Here's a prayer. Dear God, you know my life. You know where I am right now. You know everything that I'm feeling. You know everything I've been through. I want to make a commitment to you. I want to cling to you for all I'm worth. I want to trust you even in the difficult times. I want to stay with you even when I can't see you. I want to commit myself to your people. I want them to be my people. I want to commit myself to your purposes. I want them to be my purposes. Thank you, Jesus, that you became my redeemer. That you paid the price for me because you thought I was worth it. I thank you for your love and your kindness. Thank you for your grace and your mercy. Take my life. Help me exceed all my expectations. Just while we have our eyes closed, I'm just going to give you literally a few moments just to bring your own prayer to God. And then I'll finish off. Lord, I thank you that you're always gracious, always kind. And I want to pray, Lord God, that we would be men and women like Ruth, who make a hard commitment, a tough call, and yet they experience the kindness of God. And I pray that you'd stop us from being like Orpah, who loved and yet just wandered off. And she missed out. And she didn't get included in that wonderful inheritance that she could have been party to as well. Lord, I want to pray that we would never be the kind of people that miss your purposes and your blessing and your grace for our lives. But I pray that you'd lead us into commitment and put us in a place of grace. In the name of Jesus Christ, your Son. Amen.